Well, good morning, everybody. Good to see you. We're going to go ahead and address a topic today that is a little more intuitive than some of the other topics that we've discussed up to this time. Epistemology is something that Christians reflect on to a certain degree, but for the most part, it's not something we're dealing with on a theoretical level most of the time, right? Metaphysics is something that we think about, and we certainly act in a world in which we have metaphysical presuppositions and things like that, but a lot of times we don't reflect on them. But for the Christian, the question of ethics is something that we're dealing with every single day. And very oftentimes we're reflecting on what is ethically appropriate or inappropriate in this circumstance. When we're raising kids and our kids are presenting to us ethical challenges day after day, Daddy, why is this wrong? What's wrong with that? We have to learn to discern between things that are wrong in and of themselves and then things that are really issues of tradition or matters of personal preference versus matters of universal obligation, right? You have to eventually deal with those things. And then, of course, when we're at the workplace or when we go home to our own families, we have questions like, how do you justify ethical absolutes? I just disagree with your whole system of ethics. So then you get into the whole question of meta-ethics, and we'll define that. So before we begin in prayer, I just want to say, you see these three big 50-cent words on the board, all right? Do not let them intimidate you. Those words are really the, you know, for the most part, the only 50-cent words that we're going to have in today's study on ethics. And you'll find that they're just very, very helpful summaries of general traditions or principles of ethics. And they're the kind of things that we are going to deal with and that many of us already have dealt with in the real world. Okay? So before we begin, let's go ahead and open up in prayer. Is there someone who would like to lead us in prayer? Go ahead, brother. Amen. Is there somebody trying to come in there? Somebody want to just let the door open? I think they think we're praying in here still. All right, come on in. Let me hand you an outline there. Claudia, if anybody else comes in, could you hand an outline to that? Thank you. All right, couple questions first of all. First question is, how many of you are not going to be here next Sunday because of the Thanksgiving four-day holiday? Raise your hand up high. Just two of you? Okay, good. All right, we'll continue on then as scheduled. Let's see. Second point, I want to, before I introduce the whole question of ethics, again, I want to position where we actually are in this class. All right. One of you asked me this morning, Scott, are we going to be getting into the textbook that we purchased? You know, he didn't say it that way, but that's another question. I bought this $17 textbook. When are we going to use it? If you go and look at the basic long outline, you know, the meta outline, okay, the one that gives the whole view of things, you'll see that in the second half of our class, which is next year, we're actually using that book quite a bit, and we're going to read maybe one or two chapters between now and the end of this year. We don't have many lessons left between now and the end of this year, believe it or not. We're already into mid-November. So next year, starting, you know, in the spring and that, you'll see us using it quite a bit. All right. One of the reasons why we haven't been using it is because we tend not to have as much agreement with a lot of the authors about the whole issue of epistemology, okay? They tend to be more evidentialist in their approach. We tend to be more presuppositionalist in our approach, okay? And so what we thought was is that in these beginning classes, we're talking about worldview building blocks, right? These are the foundational blocks. One of them is ethics, the other one is epistemology, and the other one is metaphysics. And if you may remember that these three main building blocks, good morning, you hand her an outline. and you may remember that these three building blocks also morph together as three lenses. You remember that? Our mascot for the class are the rose-colored worldview lenses, right? And when we look out into the world, we look through the lenses of a worldview, which in its very fundamental constituent composition consists of a way of looking at ethics, a way of looking at epistemology, how we know, what do we know, how do we justify our beliefs, and then a way of looking at reality. What is reality? What is it composed of? Why does it mean anything? I'm actually going to move this over this way. I think that you guys might be able to see better over there, and you guys can see fine if I stand here. All right. So I'll just kind of relegate myself to the corner, you know, while the class continues. All right. Okay, first of all, let me go ahead and introduce this particular lecture by defining a couple of words. And it happens to be the two words right up here in the upper right-hand corner, ethics and meta-ethics. Ethics asks the question, how ought we to live our lives? How ought we to live our lives? It is the study of what is right and what is wrong, what is good, what is evil. Pretty simple. We're actually going to redefine ethics when we get to the end of the class today. We're going to redefine it as a project of theology. But before we do that, let's move on to defining metaethics. Metaethics asks the question, what is the basis for ethics? You know, just like metaphysics is seeking to look at what is ultimate reality, why does something exist rather than something? Why is there existence rather than non-existence? You know, those kinds of questions. Meta-ethics asks the question, what is the basis for ethics, for moral law? What is the good, right? What is the good? These are not settled questions among ethicists and philosophers. They are not settled questions among ethicists and philosophers any more than all the epistemological questions are settled among philosophers of epistemology, or that all philosophers who embrace different systems of metaphysics agree with one another. There is a great deal of disagreement and some might argue even disarray in the realm of secular philosophy about all three of these worldview building blocks. And I always find that phenomenon is encouraging to me. I remember when I went to college and I had this idea before I went into my psychology class that somehow or another, psychology had kind of a monolithic view or a monolithic agreement on psychology, and especially on psychology as it refutes or stands in opposition to Christianity. But then when I actually took a psychology class, I realized that there are various competing schools of psychology, some of which are directly contradictory to one another. The same thing applies in the realm of philosophy, touching on epistemology, metaphysics, and ethics. So that should be encouraging to us. When we go out into the world, it's not like we're standing up in every situation against this giant Goliath, monolithic view of ethics that everybody except Christians agrees on. Rather, we have giants that we're dealing with that are battling us, and they're hitting each other in the head with clubs. Okay? They're not only fighting off the Christians, they're fighting off one another. So that's the way we should view it. All right, now, I want to say at the beginning, too, that I'm very heavily indebted to John Frame's works, books, lectures on ethics for this lesson. And many of the quotes that I will be quoting for you are taken directly from John Frame. John Frame is a professor at Westminster. Oh, he used to be a professor at Westminster in California. Now he's at Reformed Theological Seminary down in Orlando. And he is a Christian philosopher. He is just fabulous. Has written a lot of excellent books, some of which are in our bookstore. And he has a new book coming out called The Doctrine of the Christian Life. And the good thing is that he's already published it on the internet in Word document. You know, and you think, oh, good, I'll go and print it all out. Well, you know, it's like 400 or, you know, 350 pages. So it's better to buy the book than to use all your ink for it, all right? But it is great. I mean, it is excellent, excellent stuff. And my wife will testify, I have a stack of it on my desk that I've been reading through and going through to prepare for this lesson. Just great stuff. Easy to understand, but still very creative and very sophisticated, all right? So, and if you're in, what I'll do, in fact, is I will send out to you an email that has links to every chapter of the work of that book, so you can actually click it and get the whole chapter and have it in a Word document and do whatever you want with it. All right. Well, as I mentioned, that non-Christian ethicists disagree with one another about many ethical questions. But should it be any surprise to you that Christians and non-Christians disagree on many ethical questions? I remember last year when I first taught this class, I saw a Fox program during which an expert was announcing the results of a sex survey that was taken among people age 18 to 40, I think it was. And the results of that were largely shocking to Christians, as you can imagine. And this expert is, you know, sitting up there in front of this crowd of people, and while she's sharing the results of what the typical sexual behaviors are of different people, like, for example, there were a healthy portion of people who said that they were heterosexual. There was a hefty portion of people who said that they were homosexual, not a hefty portion, but a certain portion, said they were homosexual. And then there's a group of people who classified themselves as neither, but as other. Other, you know, you're heterosexual, homosexual, or other. Okay, you know, I mean, this kind of weird stuff. And the audience was confused and, you know, wondering about this. Finally, one of the ladies in the audience who had a 14-year-old daughter was shocked about some of the things she was hearing that teenagers were doing. Okay? And the expert stood back and she said, well, listen, she said, I want to comfort you with the fact that according to our survey, only 25% of 14-year-olds actually engage in that particular behavior. As if that's a great encouragement, you know, and people are... And there were a couple of one or two times where in which the audience was like, ah, shocking! And the expert, first of all, said, why, what's wrong? Why are you guys responding like that? She reminds the whole group about a second degree that she's working on in social psychology or something like that, as if that makes her moral authority to discern between good and evil relative to all the parents and people who are sitting out there in the audience. She says, no, that's basically normal behavior. She is arguing according to a certain tradition in ethics. And more than that, she's trying to make that tradition binding upon other people. Right. In our day, what people regard as the good versus the evil are changing, like they are in every day. There seem to be certain core beliefs that people have and share in common, but even those beliefs can be eroded on account of our sinfulness and our tendency to suppress the truth by means of unrighteousness. And I'll give you an example, especially for those of you who are working out in the business world. What do most unbelievers consider to be more evil? Number one, smoking. Or number two, fornicating with someone whom you love. Smoking's more evil than sleeping with somebody who you love, with who you have a loving relationship with. All right. According to the Bible, which of the two is the most evil? What? Somebody say smoking? It sounded like it, but I'm sure nobody did. smoking while you're having a relationship. Yeah, there you go. All right, we're not going to go in that direction. but you get the point. It is crazy. People are regarding secondhand cigarette smoke as more offensive than immodest dress. Both, one of which is an eyesore, and the other of which is a nasal sore, right? You can dress however you want, you know, like worse than prostitutes dressed, you know, 60 years ago in public places. That's considered okay, acceptable, don't judge. But if, man, if you get a whiff of secondhand cigarette smoke in a grocery store, you know, that's the great evil and the great Satan. And then, you know, when you're done complaining about it, you go and have a big meal full of fried okra and everything like that, which is far worse than the whiff of cigarette smoke for your health. But anyway, you'll notice in the outline that I had emailed to all of you, Do We Need God to Be Moral? A debate between John Frame and Paul Kurtz, that in that article, Paul Kurtz referred to Margaret Sanger. He referred to Margaret Sanger as a hero in American history and said that she, along with certain others, led an ethical life even though she rejected biblical morality. Well, for those of you who know about Margaret Sanger, you're scratching your head as a Christian wondering why in the world of all atheists in American history who have impacted culture, why in the world would Paul Kurtz refer to Margaret Sanger as an example of ethical behavior? Margaret Sanger was the founder of Planned Parenthood earlier on in the 1900s. She was an early champion of birth control, but she tended to direct it in this way because she believed strongly that we needed to implement birth control, especially for minorities, especially for blacks. Because the more you control the birth rate of blacks, the more you control the population itself. And you shrink that population and allow the more superior races to grow. Okay, she believed in what is called eugenics and was a part of the eugenics movement. She was a committed Darwinist, which, of course, eugenics and birth control and all that stuff is just a logical outflow of social Darwinism when it's applied to the races as they compete with one another. She also advocated the removal of all moral restraints in favor of what she deemed was healthy sexual expression. She wrote, quote, "Through sex, mankind will attain the great spiritual illumination which will transform the world and light up the only path to an earthly paradise," close quote. Now, you ladies, how would you like to have a woman like Margaret Sanger living next door to your house, interacting with your husband and your sons? But Paul Kurtz, in a debate that's published in Free Inquiry magazine, refers to Margaret Sanger as an example of ethical behavior that ought to be respected. Obviously, Christians and non-Christians have very different views of what is and what is not ethical behavior, right? Now, in your experience of listening to unbelievers, family members, co-workers, friends, in your experiencing in listening to unbelievers talk about ethics, what are some of the ways that you have heard unbelievers ground ethics? Or give reasons for why this is appropriate conduct versus this kind of conduct? I'm just going to throw this open. Yeah?
The biggest thing I've heard is it doesn't hurt anybody else, it's okay.
Doesn't hurt anybody else, so it's okay. All right, very good. And that will fall into the teleological principle. All right? Yes?
We have this inside of us where we just kind of instinctively know good.
Very good. That's a deontological principle. G.E. Moore was, along with another philosopher, the founder of what's called intuitivism, you know, where you sit down and you can't come to ethics by any empirical route. You can't come to ethics through some kind of morbid self-introspection like the existentialists. Instead, you come to it and you present it to your mind, and in some kind of a mysterious way, you just know whether it's good or bad, right? Any others? Oh, Claudia. Whatever makes the most people happy. Kind of the reverse of what you said. As long as it doesn't hurt people, it's okay. And the reverse of that, whatever maximizes happiness for the greatest number of people. That's the teleological principle. Very good. Any others?
I think my mom would say the fact that it's like to each his own.
To each his own? Existential. I'm glad we got all three principles here. All right? To each his own. The existential principle, and we'll talk about that. So you can see that just in basic conversations with next-door neighbors and friends and family members, in just a short time, we have come up with a deontological form of ethics for justifying ethics, a teleological, and an existential. So now let's get into defining what these are and what the problems of each of them are. Okay? So let me erase this. Now, if you look at your outline for today's class, actually, I need an outline. I'll take Jimmy's. No, that's all right. It's not your fault. Do we have one more? Yeah, we'll pass it over this way. You just lost your outline, Jimmy. I'm sorry. He knows it all already. All right. If you look at the outline, you'll notice that we're going to look at today two main points. All right? Point one, the futility of autonomous ethics. Point two, the harmony of Christian ethics. So point one is going to introduce the problems with non-Christian approaches to ethics, particularly secular approaches. Point number two is going to show how the Christian worldview harmonizes and makes sense of ethical principles. All right? Now, going back to point one, the futility of autonomous ethics, we're going to look at, first of all, three ethical principles, and you can see them up there. Then we're going to look at the problems associated with those principles. So again, very clear outline of the direction we're going to go today. Next week, we're going to finish our class on ethics, but we're going to introduce point three, four, and five in this overall outline. Now, I don't know if you noticed, but when you were reading Paul Kurtz in the debate, Do We Need God to Be Moral? Paul Kurtz, who is the agnostic or possibly atheist, says this. He says, "The history of philosophy demonstrates the efforts of great thinkers from Aristotle to Immanuel Kant, John Stuart Mill, John Dewey, and Sidney Hook to develop a rational basis for ethical conduct. Ethics, they said, can be autonomous and needs no theological justification." Later on, he makes this statement. "A good life is achievable by men and women without the need for divinity," or without the need for God. Well, there is a great example of an unbeliever defining autonomous ethics. Remember how we defined autonomous? Autonomous ethics, autonomous epistemology. These are approaches to epistemology and to ethics that disregards God's revelation and instead seeks to establish it based upon some kind of independent thinking or independent principle or on some idol external to God. For example, I will base my empirical worldview on my sensory experience alone. Without any regard to what Revelation says, I'll evaluate it based on my own criteria. Or I have some principle of rationality that I have presupposed in advance, and I'm going to bring everything to the bar of that rational principle, including any claims about Christianity. But the Christian worldview instead says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. And when it comes to ethics, the Christian worldview quotes God. Be holy, for I am holy. That's what God says. So ethics, according to the Christian, is founded in the character of God and is made known to us through the commands of God and also through natural revelation. But when people reject that, they come up with autonomous ways of doing ethics. Things like your father and your mother and your dad and other people who we meet every day. And they typically have gravitated towards one of three principles or an attempt to harmonize these three principles in some way or another. First of all, the deontological principle. That's our first 50-cent word, the deontological principle. This word comes from the Greek verb translated ought, O-U-G-H-T, I had to look how that was spelled, or must, or owe. The idea is that a good act is a response to duty, even at the price of self-sacrifice. What is a good act? What is a virtuous behavior? A virtuous behavior is when you do your duty even at the price of self-sacrifice. The deontological principle emphasizes duty and obligation, irrespective of its consequence upon human happiness or upon how I feel about it inside. This tradition includes such philosophers as Plato, or Stoicism, Immanuel Kant, and G.E. Moore. Now, I don't expect you to know those names. Some of you do know them, and so I wanted to state which philosophers tend to be associated with the deontological tradition. Now, what these philosophers do is they say, you know, we need to find ethical norms or ethical criteria that are universal, necessary, and obligatory. We can't be like the, you know, the subjectivists down here, the existentialists, that say that there are no moral norms external to the self, and that is that each of us individually has to choose his own moral standards and live according to them, regardless of what impact they have upon anybody else. They say, no, we're not like them. If the ethical enterprise were an airplane, for that airplane even to get off of the runway, it needs to establish ethical principles that are universal and not merely personal subjective kind of things. They need to be the kind of things that create obligation and are not merely arbitrary things. Like, you know, Carlos, I like the taste of lemons. Therefore, you ought to like lemons. That's me asserting my personal preference upon Carlos. Carlos feels no moral obligation to eat lemons and to enjoy them, right? And so ethics needs to find obligation. And also, they need to be necessary principles, not principles that are merely after the fact kind of afterthoughts. You know, well, you know, in order to get A done, we should have done B instead, now that we look at it in the back. These are principles that have a moral necessity upon every people, all people at all times, irrespective of whether those people acknowledge them or not. That's what the deontological principle asserts. Now, these norms, these criteria, cannot be discovered through sensory experience. They cannot be discovered through observing phenomena in the world or by introspection, looking inside my heart and trying to find out what they are. They cannot be contingent upon the happiness or pleasure of people. Otherwise, they're not laws that are universal, because people are made happy by a variety of different things. And when you take even the American culture, in one century, people are generally made happy by this kind of thing. But then you go to another century and the culture has drifted in its attitudes and its worldview. Now it's made happy by other things. So the universal principle doesn't apply in that situation if it's based upon human happiness. No, these are laws that exist almost like free-floating entities out there, you know? They float around and we're obligated to them, irrespective of whether it makes us happy or not. Okay? Now, yes?
How do they deal with the jihad principle of the Muslims?
How do these people deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's right, it's moral, it's necessary that you go out and blow yourself up in order to defeat these infidels.
Yeah.
What do they do with that?
Well, they'll it depends on each philosopher. Some philosophers will like Immanuel Kant. He might put some of the assertions of the Quran into his ethical system, which is called the categorical imperative, and to ask the question: if we will a jihad for every person, what kind of result will that have on all of us? In other words, can you maximize this behavior so that it becomes a universal behavior? And if so, then what happens? See what I'm saying? That is one of that's the deontological principle for Immanuel Kant. Okay? And each one will go differently. G.E. Moore might say, you know, I sit down and I look at the Quran, and through an intuition, I seek to discern in this kind of mystical way whether it is good or not. And if it's not good, then I reject it. And of course, many intuitionists would reject the Islamic way of looking at things. Yes?
I hadn't in my own mind put Kant and Moore together before,
G.E. Moore?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What are they using? Are they using intuition as their deontological principle?
You got it. That's it. It's not that G.E. Moore and Immanuel Kant come to the same conclusions, but they both have this idea that moral law cannot be based upon existential principle alone or a
tele... I guess I'm thinking intuition.
Yes. That sounds like a... Yeah, that's right. And that sounds like a... That's one of the inconsistencies that develops in some of these philosophers, as I understand it. I've not read Immanuel Kant, but reading John Frame, apparently Immanuel Kant says a lot of things like, we cannot, he criticizes the teleological tradition. We cannot base our ethics upon what makes the greatest number of people happy. And we cannot do that. But then Immanuel Kant, in his categorical imperative, cannot help but bring these two other perspectives to bear in some way or another on his own principle. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And what we'll find out, you got it. And what you brought up is a very, very good point. It's something that we're going to emphasize, and that is that no one principle can account for ethics. And what happens is that when a given philosopher or a group of people tend to gravitate towards one as the primary dominating principle, or even try to be a purist with respect to one principle, they end up not being able to account for the whole ethical enterprise. They end up appealing to stuff that goes in this category and stuff that goes in this category. But as we'll see in just a few minutes, when you take each of these principles alone without presupposing God, they cannot harmonize with one another. All right? So we'll look into that in just a couple of points. So as you can see, for the deontological ethicist, obligations, moral obligations, are almost godlike without God. Right? They have a universal and necessary obligation upon all people, irrespective of whether we agree with them or not. Okay? Now, it's interesting to see how unbelievers cannot escape ascribing godlike attributes to parts of reality. They can't help but do it. How many times do you hear about the processes of nature being referred to as Mother Nature? And she does this, and she does that. And describing aspects of nature in terms of a creator. I'm currently going through a module for my work. I'm in veterinarian health, and on equine health issues, you know, the fact that horses tend to get ulcers in their stomach and why. And I've noticed that the author of this module, on the one hand, talks about the horse evolving as a grazing animal. Okay, the word evolve comes up again and again. But then on the other hand, when he's describing the complexity of the horse's stomach, he says the stomach is designed for a continual supply of food. Otherwise, a stable horse who doesn't eat frequently may suffer the consequences of stomach ulcers because that the horse's stomach is always pumping acid, irrespective of whether he's eating or not. So they cannot help but put words like design in there, or Mother Nature, personifying reality, personifying moral rule obligations, as if they have some kind of person behind them. But of course, we don't want to say that God exists. We just have these free-floating moral absolutes to which all people are obligated. All right, that is the first principle, the deontological principle. Now, you may have noticed that when we talked about the deontological principle, that there are some, there are some pretty good things in there, aren't there? Are moral absolutes universal, necessary, and obligatory? Yeah. So you see, even in natural revelation, unbelievers are detecting, hey, if moral obligations are to be real and genuine, they've got to be necessary, they've got to be universal, and they've got to create a real obligation, irrespective of whether, you know, we want to agree with it or not. All right? So there's something good about this tradition. But when God is missing, there are problems, which we'll discuss in just a minute.
Who comes up with these universal... Who gets to be the one to pick? Like all these people you've mentioned...
They disagree with one another. Plato, the early Greek philosopher Plato, talks about the realm of the forms or the ideas, and that somehow in our pre-existent life we observed these forms like treeness, and mathematical equations, and the perfect square, and the perfect circle. These are the norms. And in this hierarchy of this world of abstract entities, at the very top is the good, Okay? And so now when we're living in a world of matter and change and chance, our struggle is to try and to discern the abstract form of the good in our own ethical behavior. And you end up with problems. Then another philosopher comes along and says it comes through intuition. You see what I'm saying? So they all tend to agree that there are obligations to which all are obligated that have a universal quality to them. But exactly what those obligations are, how you get to them, they disagree with one another. Okay? All right, next principle, the teleological principle. Some of you have heard about the teleological argument for God's existence. The word teleological carries with it the idea of goal or designed or end. It comes from the Greek word translated goal, end. This tradition has included such thinkers as Epicurus and also most hedonistic philosophies, philosophies that say that the good is what makes me happy. Most hedonistic philosophies are in some way or another associated with or based upon a teleological principle. Aristotle, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, John Dewey. Basically, what these folks are saying is this. Tell me if you've ever heard this before. A good act maximizes the happiness of living creatures. What is the good? Well, a virtuous act, a virtuous behavior, is a behavior that maximizes the happiness of living creatures. A good act does good. All right, we'll talk about it a little more. An act, according to a utilitarian, all right, which is a species of teleological ethics, and which is probably one of the most common ethical principles that is asserted today for people. An act is morally good or virtuous if it brings about happiness for the individual or for the largest number of people. All right? Let's take an example. I go to work and I want to smoke in the office. All right? And I really don't like smoking, by the way. The fact that I keep bringing that up, I don't want anybody to infer that I somehow putting smoking in a good category, all right? But I want to smoke in my office. Well, we go to the office, we take a vote. And it turns out that 80% of the office is made very unhappy by my smoking. Therefore, my smoking in terms of that office becomes, as it were, ethically bad behavior. Now, if we were to put that in a culture, that kind of phenomenon in a whole culture, not just in an office, you determine whether something is good or bad, morally virtuous or morally evil, whether a behavior is good or bad, based upon its observable impact upon either the self, this is good because it makes me happy, or, and it certainly sounds, you know, more ethically responsible, whether it makes the greatest number of people happy or the greatest number of people sad. So it's a very empirical enterprise. It's an enterprise that is based upon the observation of the consequences of ethical behavior. It's not like necessarily like the deontological, where consequences to obeying the deontological principle, whatever a given philosopher says, the consequences don't really matter. You just do what's right, pull up your bootstraps and do what's right, irrespective of what consequence it has upon individuals. You do the good, even at the point of self-sacrifice. The teleological ethicist comes along and says, no, the good, the virtuous life, is a life lived whose impact upon culture maximizes happiness in the greatest number of people. And it's something that we establish by observation, almost like a scientific enterprise. And this is often the choice of empiricists, people who are epistemologically committed to empiricism, namely that all knowledge comes through the gates of the eyes and the ears and tactile and that kind of thing. The deontological principle tends to be advocated by people who are more from the rationalist school, people who don't base knowledge claims, ultimate knowledge claims upon sensory experience, but on self-evident principles and self-evident axioms on which and from which they deduce the whole fabric of human knowledge. All right? So that's the teleological principle. All right? A good act maximizes the happiness of living creatures. Now, is there something good about this principle? Biblically. There you go. You put God in it. What is the goal of Christian ethics?
To enjoy God.
And even going beyond that, to glorify God. To glorify God. We might even put it this way. It sounds a little bit cheesy, but it is true. The chief end of man is to make God happy, to glorify Him, to honor Him. And we find that our happiness is established insofar as we are following and fulfilling that goal, our ultimate happiness is. So there is something right about it. Remove God from that picture. Now it's become an empirical enterprise based upon the happiness of humans. And we'll see the problems of that in just a while. Christian hedonism, yes. Now, the existential principle, all right, this is a broad movement of which the 20th century school of writers such as Jean-Paul Sartre is only a part. Historically, it's rooted in the ideas of Soren Kierkegaard and Nietzsche. You've heard of Nietzsche. Martin Heidegger and Carl Jaspers. This is similar to the ethical thought of the ancient Greek sophists, or sophists. We talk about sophistry. You know, they're into rhetoric and power rather than into any kind of universal moral obligations that to which they're obligated. It's similar to the ethical thought of Karl Marx. And also of a movement called emotivism of the logical positivists in the early to mid 20th century. And if you don't know what I'm talking about there, it doesn't matter. Okay, logical positivism had its heyday for about 30 years, and then like an airplane out of gas, it crashed. Okay. Postmodern ethics is a part of the tradition of existential ethics. So I'm just giving you a sense for where we're going with this. Now, probably the most outspoken and consistent supporter of existentialism in our time was Jean-Paul Sartre, who sought to elucidate an ethic that was consistent with atheism. Since God doesn't exist, I have no predefined essence or nature. No personal being has created me and defined who I am, what I am, and what my limitations are. Rather, I simply exist, and I am radically free to define for myself my own essence and my own nature. I must not submit to how others define me, either my mom or my dad or my girlfriend or my culture, unless indeed I make a choice to submit myself and my own radical freedom to have them define me. Instead, I am to define for myself who I am, irrespective of the consequences upon other people, and without any regard to some kind of overarching criteria or standard. I am completely and totally a law to myself. And I just happen to just exist in this world of chance occurrences, and there's no God to define who I am or what I am. I define myself. I make up my own moral standards and then live consistently with them. That is self-actualizing. I'm just simply living, as it were, according to my own stipulations and standards of morality. Now, this movement tends to focus not on objective rules for behavior, the deontological principle, nor on any calculated goals that should identify my behavior either as good or bad. Rather, I'm radically free to choose who I am. I choose to define the good for myself. I choose the rules, if any, by which I ought to live out my life. I must self-actualize. Now, this is radical autonomy, right? This is radical ethical autonomy. That is existentialism. And, you know, there have been a number of people who have been influenced by that. I haven't really got into the philosophy of Madonna, but I would assume that Madonna, you know, being the kind of European liberal that she is and how she acts and behaves and how she inspires people just to live, to kind of define themselves, not be pushed into any category by anybody else, and just live how you want, irrespective of its consequences on other people, unless you choose what consequences you want to bring upon other people or what ways you do not want to impact other people. All right, Madonna might be a popular example of an existentialist living out her principle. He might be an existentialist in how he behaves, yeah, but I mean, he knows this exists, you know, tries to get you in that way. Well, actually, any of these principles can lead you down a wrong path, taking an isolation from God. I mean, some of the great atheist scholars are teleological ethicists. You know, they really embrace that point. If you read the debate between John Frame and Paul Kurtz, you'll see that Paul Kurtz actually appeals to all three of these principles in trying to defend and ground ethics. And John Frame calls him on it. And now we're going to move to the point B, problems with the ethical principles. And this may be as far as we get today. All right. Letter B, problems with the ethical principles. Well, the first one is that the principles don't harmonize with one another once you have kicked God out of the picture. Remove God from the universe, and these three principles cannot be harmonized with one another. The problem is, though, is that if you're going to carry out any kind of solid ethical enterprise, you need to have a norm, you need to take consequences into account, and you need to have some kind of focus upon the existential aspect of man, right? I mean, the scripture says that when we give our tithes, we're to do it cheerfully, for God loves a cheerful giver. There's an existential aspect to it, right? There's a teleological aspect to it. We give in order to help other people, that kind of thing. Then there's a deontological aspect to it. God commands us to give, okay? So all three of these principles, the ethicist realizes, the non-Christian ethicist, I've got to have something of each one. It's hard just to be a pure deontological. But the problem is that they tend to repel one another. You know, it's like taking two magnets. You ever done that before? And you turn the magnet in the opposite direction, and you set one magnet down, and you try to push it close to the second magnet. What happens to the second magnet? It moves away. And you put there's just kind of a natural repelling tendency. Now you can take duct tape and tie them together and say, look how they cohere together, how beautifully. And that's what some philosophers try to do. They try to take, as it were, duct tape and tie these things together, but they're contradictory. They oppose one another. Let me give you an example. No ethicist exemplifies exclusively any one of these principles because ethics requires a standard. It requires a deontological standard. It requires a goal. And it requires motivation, the existential principle. And no one principle can satisfy all that's required. Therefore, many philosophers seek to harmonize. But without God, it's hard to see how they can. First of all, let's look at a tension between the teleological and the deontological principle. The teleological principle says that ethical action leads to happiness. But the deontological principle states that in order to do our duty, we must somehow sacrifice our happiness. Right? Sometimes Christians have been very influenced by this. Well, you know, the fact that I've been serving all these people all these years and I've been enjoying it, I'm not really good because of that, because I'm enjoying what I'm doing. For it to be really ethically meaningful, I have to do it even when I don't enjoy it. That's when when I will to do what I'm supposed to do, irrespective of whether I'm happy about it or not. That is a non-Christian way of doing ethics. And that's, John Piper's point out, that's the influence of Immanuel Kant in Christian ethics. So you see, the deontological principle says to do our duty, we must sometimes sacrifice. So sacrifice happiness, but this one says it's what makes the most number of people happy or what makes the individual happy that is the good. Here's another contradiction. The teleological and the deontological principles join together and say that our ethical responsibility is objective. It's grounded outside of ourselves. But the existentialist says that our goodness is inward and therefore is subjective. So it's very hard to harmonize existentialism, which says that moral standards are subjective and inward, versus the deontological and the teleological ethicists who say that, no, ethics are grounded outside of ourselves. See the difference? Inside of ourselves? These two say it's outside of ourselves. Now, the deontological principle, here's another contradiction, says that we are subject to moral law that declares our duty apart from inclination or the consequences of our acts. You do whatever is right, irrespective of its consequences upon people or upon yourself. But the teleological principle and the existential principle measures our goodness by the consequences of our actions upon people or upon our inner life. Do you see how they their intention? Yes. Not living authentically, according to his own standards. Yeah, or being brought under the slavery of other people's ideas, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. To him, to his own law. He's not living authentically according to his own rules. Maybe he's living inconsistently, unless he makes up the rule that it's okay to live inconsistently. Then there's maybe no evil that he can do. You mean to the... Maybe if you set up your own ethical enterprise and violated them, and one of your own rules is that if you violate your own ethical principles, you see what I'm saying? You could violate your own law, and if you assume that the violation of your own law is evil, then you've committed evil according to your own principle. I think that's how it would work. All right, here's another one. The existential principle down here says that it's wrong to measure a person's goodness by anything external to himself, right? Just what you were saying. But the teleological and deontological principles say that we may measure goodness by consequences and norms of action, respectively. Now, since these principles don't harmonize well, a given non-Christian thinker will often tend to polarize towards one of these three principles. But this approach also has its problems. Somebody says, well, you know, I really can't bring all three of these into agreement. I mean, I can, but I have to tie them together with duct tape. You know, and the whole time they're kind of repelling one another. So what I'll do is I'm just going to be a teleological ethicist. I'm just going to focus on one of them and get rid of the tensions that exist between each of the three traditions. Well, that has serious problems too if you don't believe in God. So first of all, let's look at the deontological problems. First of all, the question is, how do we gain knowledge of the universal moral principle? Somebody in this class, I think, asked that question. Kant talks about the categorical imperative, and I don't even fully understand that. But most ethicists who have looked at Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative look at it today and say that it was a failure, and that you could find ways around it. The most ingenious person could end up maximizing all kinds of absurd ethical standards based upon how ingenious he was to manipulate through his categorical imperative. G.E. Moore's intuitionism. You sit down and you intuit what is the good. How many people do you think are going to come up to the same conclusions of what the good is based on intuition? Back in G.E. Moore's day, there was a general consensus about what is good and what is evil because of the influence of Christianity upon the culture. So people tended to look at things the same way, and it made total sense that they could intuit what the good was or what the evil was. Another problem, how do abstract universal moral obligations apply to the real world? Here you have these abstract principles like Plato's the good. And the problem with Plato's ethics is that you become so abstract in defining the good that eventually it has no meaning. And you can't apply it to particular ethical situations in the world. And even Plato later on admitted that his basic questions were still unanswered. They tend to come up with abstract, universal moral obligations out there that have no real application to the world. And in that sense, they're similar to the rationalists in terms of epistemology. Remember, the rationalists would start off with propositions like, the laws of logic are my foundation, and I can't trust my sensory experience, and from the laws of logic and a couple of other axioms, I'm going to try and deduce the whole fabric of human understanding. Well, the problem is you have these abstract laws of logic with no content, and therefore you can't deduce things from them because there's no content to them.
Example of a moral that one of these kinds would have in Jesus in the world.
That's a good question. I may not be able to go into that right now, and it would require me to really think about it. The best example I came up with immediately was Plato's The Good. All right? Here's the good up there, and Plato keeps trying to define what the good, what the abstract good is, but he comes to a place where he can't define it anymore. He cannot define it by, maybe he can talk about its negation or something like that, but it becomes this kind of this principle that is mystical and not really knowable. So when you're trying, as a Platonic deontological ethicist, you're walking around trying to figure out what the good is, but the good is a principle that's almost mystical and cannot be defined, and you can't apply this abstract universal principle to particular situations, like whether it's okay to abort a child and things like that. Well, it would depend on which deontological ethicist and what his particular principles are. A good example would be the intuitionist. Okay, there's a good example. All right, here you have, you know, somebody who believes in intuitionism, and a moral situation is put before him, the issue of abortion. Is it okay for my 14-year-old daughter to have an abortion because we don't want to prevent her from getting an education? G.E. Moore says that the way that you discern the rightness or the wrongness of that ethical situation is you present it before the eyes of your mind, as it were, and you just intuit. Yeah, that's wrong. That's wrong. What are your reasons for it? Well, it's not an issue of the consequences upon the baby or upon the woman. You just discern whether it's right or wrong based on intuition. Well, you get a room full of people who sit down and intuit that issue, and there's no content in the intuition to be applied to the particular circumstance. You see what I'm saying? It's more of just, it actually becomes almost like an existential kind of thing. All right? Yes, Jimmy. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, maybe. Well, actually, I would say no. Even then, it wouldn't work. All right. And the reason for that, for my saying that, is that in the Garden of Eden, when man wasn't fallen, it required both natural revelation, but also word revelation, special revelation to define the tree, define what was acceptable behavior, what was unacceptable, and that kind of thing. So that God has made us such that we require both natural and special revelation, even in an unfallen state. I'd like to answer more questions, but I'm going to have to move on to the next point because we're literally at the end here. In fact, what I'm going to probably do, I'm going to stop at a critique of the deontological problem. All right. What we'll do is next time we'll critique the teleological principle and then the existential principle, and then from there we'll move on to how Christian ethics harmonizes all of that together in a beautiful way. So, summary is this. Folks, don't be upset and fearful when you hear very smart, stuffy philosophers talk about ethics, and they're committed to one or more of these principles apart from God. Problem is that it comes to dead ends. Okay? And you can have a measure of confidence that, hey, you know what? Ethics is really like this. In thy light, O God, we see light. And it's the commands of God based upon his own nature of moral holiness. The good is God. And God commands for us based upon his own character. All right? His character defines what is good, what is evil. And then he gives that information to us in the form of words so that we know what is the good and what is the evil and what is our goal in life. All right, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much that you exist. We thank you for creating us. We thank you for giving us moral rules that are not arbitrary, but that you expect us to live out our lives even as you do. We think of your Son who said, "Be perfect, for I am perfect," and how you said, "Be holy, for I am holy." Oh Lord, we want to imitate you in our behavior. And we pray that you would help us to do that, to live out godly and faithful lives to you. And also that you'd give us discernment, how to critique our neighbor's ethical views, to show them how that it's futile and how that it really, in their heart of hearts, they know that the Christian worldview is true and they know that that you exist because they continue to act as if you exist even though they deny it. We thank you for all your mercies and pray that you'd prepare us for worship today. In Jesus' name, amen.